Barry Shally, I'm a program associate at Holden. And this is going to be a session on the third world debt crisis, just trying really to give an introduction to what it is. I mean, we hear about it, trying to talk a little bit about the history of it, why it has developed the way it has, and looking at what the debt crisis is really in terms of what its impact is on the third world. Tomorrow, we will follow this up by talking a little bit about what the impact or the implications are for us as North American Christians, and talking both in terms of what the impact is economically on North America, but also some of the things that we as Christians need to be concerned about in terms of its effect on the third world and what we can do about that, what some of the proposed solutions are. Let me say from the outset that I am not a professional economist. I do have a background and a degree in public policy, which certainly involves a lot of economics, and I have done some studies since then at a place at the University of Massachusetts for the Center for Popular Economics. And this has become a real concern of mine. I feel like the debt crisis is an issue that very few people know much about, and it's not something that we hear very much about other than in the economic sections of the newspaper or the business sections. And it's more of a concern for banking and the business aspect than it is in terms of a social or political issue. And that really concerns me because I think that it's probably one of the most crucial issues going on right now in terms of its overall impact on what happens in the world to poor people. So I've been doing a few sessions on this since I've been at Holden, and hopefully I can, there are probably some of you who are quite well aware of some of this and can help us out. And one more thing before I actually start, and that is that I think very often, like we talk about math phobias, there's often an economics phobia among people. There's a sense that we sort of tune out when we talk about economics because we know ahead of time we can't understand it. And I hope that I can explain this. I think I can in a way that's relatively simple. We're going to really condense a very complex problem into a fairly short, brief explanation. I hope that you can at least get a basic understanding of what it's all about. And also just to say that I really would encourage everyone to really try to work through some of that. I really think it's very hard to be at all involved and concerned about issues in the world without having some basic understanding of economics. Not that we all have to understand all the curves and the graphs and all that, but to at least be willing to struggle with some of those issues. So, with that, let me start. And please feel free to interrupt at any point with any questions or comments that you have. What I'm going to do is try to... This will be a little bit more of a presentation than tomorrow's will be. I'm just going to try to lay it out, and hopefully we'll, if everything goes according to plan, we'll have plenty of time at the end for some questions and discussion. Okay, first of all, just in terms of the immensity of what we're talking about, at the present time, the third world, and we're talking about, no special definition of the third world other than what I think what our general understanding of that is, but primarily Latin America has the largest debt, but Africa, Indonesia, Philippines, the total amount of money owed by third world countries right now is around $1 trillion. Now, in terms of our own national debt, that's not necessarily, doesn't seem like a problem if you distribute it among a lot of countries, but when you think about the economies of the countries we're talking about, we're talking about a huge amount of money. That is essentially $400 per person in the third world in the countries we're talking about, which is more than the average annual income of people in the third world. So in other words, people in the third world per person owe more than they earn per year. Let me just give you some figures. I've written a few up here. Brazil owes $108 billion. I'll talk about what DR means in a minute. Argentina, 35 billion. Mexico, 102 billion. Indonesia, 44 billion. Some others
are... To the United States or just owed
no,
everybody?
No, they owe... Very... I'll get into some more of that. But most of that is owed to Western banks and to Western governments. United States certainly being the largest. We're talking about banks like Citicorp, Bank America. Those are not Bank America. Bank. What is it? Bank. Well, anyway, Citicorp is the biggest, and about seven of those huge banks, primarily based. Chase Manhattan is one of them. You're also talking about Western banks in Europe, and then there are some loans that are from governments. That we're also talking about. There are a little bit of this money comes from Eastern Bloc loans, but not very many. This really has happened over about the last 10 or 15 years is what is really why it's now a crisis. In 1975, Latin America, all countries together, owed about $75 billion. In 1985, it's up to over $300 billion. So we'll talk a little bit about why that happened. It's four times the amount of debt in about 10 years. Let me continue with some of the others. Yugoslavia has a $20 billion debt. Nigeria, Indonesia, Philippines are all up there. And then almost all of Latin America have quite large debts in comparison to their economies. One of the problems is that we're talking about a situation where these countries simply cannot pay them off. The DR is the debt ratio, and essentially what that is the percentage of a country's export earnings that goes to paying off their interest every year. And I'm not even talking about principal right now, I'm talking about just their interest payments. Brazil, in order to meet its interest payments, has to pay 38% of what it earns from its entire, all of its exports in 1 year, just to pay the interest. Argentina and Mexico are around the same amount. Indonesia is 28%. We're talking about countries that are trying to develop, and they can't even pay the interest. So much of their resources go into just simply dealing with the debts. And it's really gotten to a point where people are starting, finally, I think, to recognize that they cannot keep up with them. And in fact, I'm fond of quoting Henry Kissinger, because I don't get to quote Henry Kissinger very much, because I don't usually agree with him. But according to Henry Kissinger, these payments simply cannot be made. None of the major debtor countries will be able simultaneously to pay its debt, achieve economic growth, and maintain its political and social equilibrium. That's from Henry Kissinger. It is simply straining countries, and they're starting to say that. And in fact, what has happened in the last year is Brazil has finally just said, we can't pay anymore. And they're in a moratorium right now trying to renegotiate. They're not paying. Peru has said, we'll continue to pay, but we will never pay more than 10% of our export earnings. And so they have locked in the amount that they will pay every year to their exports. Some other countries now, Ecuador has stopped payments. And Cuba, Castro has been trying for years now to try to get all the debtor countries together to form a cartel and essentially say, stop paying all together and you might have some power. That really has not worked. But more and more you're finding countries that are saying, you've got to renegotiate this in some form that we work with it or stop it or what. But we can no longer pay this stuff.
What was the money given to them for in the first place?
Okay, I'm going to get to that. I'm simply trying right now. Okay. That's the next thing. That's a good question. I'll just move right into that and say beforehand that what the effect has been is that the third world right now is in the worst depression since the 1930s. Now, we don't usually hear that. We just know the third world's in bad shape, but they always have been, so we don't assume that anything's worse now than it ever has been. But in fact, economically, They're in the worst depression since the 1930s. Okay, now let's talk about why it happened. How has all this occurred? I just want to briefly say, and I won't go into a lot of the history here, but you can really trace this all the way back to colonialism and to a system in which you have Western countries, Western European countries primarily, settling what are now third world countries and setting up economies that are primarily based on sending back resources to Western Europe. So the agricultural systems in these countries have for years been primarily based on what we call cash crops. Things like cotton, tobacco, sugar, coffee, cashews. Agricultural products that have very little food value for the people in that country. Their entire economic power is based on getting money for those crops from Western countries that can process those and use them in manufacturing or for our own coffee and those kinds of things. So that's, and you'll see why in a minute why that's important.
Well, oranges are brought into Florida for the orange juice from Brazil. Because over the years now they've had frost, they haven't been able to fill their quota, mm-hmm. so they bring it from Brazil.
Right. And there's a lot of, all of our products.
And isn't it true that these countries don't have a good, strong middle class? They're the extremely wealthy up here and extremely
mostly,
poor down here?
Yeah, mostly that's true. That's true. And there are very few at the top, mostly at the bottom. That's right.
I think they said like 28 families in Colombia that control the wealth and control the church and control the military.
That's probably true. I don't know the exact numbers in Colombia.
That's what we were told.
Right. The thing that has happened is that these commodities or these cash crops have never there's never been agreements reached between the third world countries that are producing these products and the Western or first world countries that are buying them in terms of any kind of stabilization of the prices. The prices are completely left up to the world market, and they fluctuate up and down all over the place. So it's very hard for third world countries to do the kind of planning that first world countries are used to doing. And it's primarily the first world, countries like the United States, who have always resisted any kind of price stabilization because we are the ones that have the economic power. If you move past colonialism, then another sort of important date is 1944. There was a conference in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, of a lot of the Allied countries, essentially towards the end of the war, and what they were trying to do was put together some economic policies and agreements that when the war was over, they could then move with. And I won't go into a lot of detail about that, except to say that that's when what is called the IMF, or the International Monetary Fund, was founded. And that originally was to monitor short-term loans, to help countries with balance of payments problems, and still that's its major purpose, and it's now its power and its involvement in third world debt has really expanded over the last 20, 25 years. The IMF originally, I think, after it is affiliated with the United Nations, but it's not controlled by the United Nations. It has a very unique kind of structure. There are now 148 nations that are members of it. You almost have to be a member of it. And yet, your voting power is totally determined by your economic power. So, for instance, out of 148 nations, the United States has 20% of the voting power in the IMF. Not exactly what you'd call a democratic institution. I'll come back to that in a second. I'm just going to have to set up some stuff here and then try to explain later. Okay, so after the war, you have a situation in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s where a lot of third world countries are becoming independent for the first time. I mean, that's what happened in the 50s and 60s. There was a lot of concern about how do we help third world countries develop. And in fact, the trade between 1950 and 1980 grew from $60 billion of trade to $2,000 billion of trade, or $2 trillion. So the trade in those 30 years grew tremendously. the problem was that the exports, the trade that we're talking about, dropped. The amount of money brought in from exports dropped in comparison to what they were having to pay for their imports and for oil especially over that time. But generally still, during up until the early 1970s, things were still relatively stable, and there was still hope that that kind of development would take place. There were loans that were poured in to try to help with the balance of payments, and there was still a sense that with loans and some good financial management that the development would still take place and things would be okay. Well, what happened in 1973 for the first time? Anybody that might really affect finance? It really certainly affected us. Oil, yeah. All right. Certainly affected us. And we were waiting in line for oil and we were paying all of a sudden twice as much as we had before. Well, a couple things happened at the same time with the skyrocketing of oil prices. Number one, and this is where we really start seeing where the debt crisis occurs. Number one is that all of a sudden you have a lot of countries like Saudi Arabia who have huge amounts of cash that they didn't have before. Now, what are they going to do with this money all of a sudden? They take it to Western banks and they invest it. Now, all of a sudden, Western banks have huge amounts of money. Now, this banking industry is fairly simple in some ways, and that is you have to have money which you loan out at higher interest than what you're paying those people to put their money in your bank, and that's how you make money. I mean, that's at least one of the ways. If the banks all of a sudden are loaded up with millions of dollars that they're having to pay interest on to these oil dealers, then what are they going to try to do with the money? They're going to try to get it out of there as fast as they can, and even at some reduced interest rates to start with, because if they don't loan it out, they're paying interest on it. So they have got to get the money out. All right, so that's the first thing, that in the mid-70s, you have a huge amount of what we call petrodollars that are in the world market, and bankers got to find something to do with it.
Excuse me, they're loaning the money to the third world nations.
All right, well, that's what they start doing. All right, they have all this money, and there's incredible stories about how all these young junior executive bankers are just literally lapping at the heels of third world government officials, trying to get, throwing money at every imaginable project, trying to get rid of this money. I don't want to overstate this. I think some banks were very responsible with that, but there was a lot of money that was loaned in ways that even the banks would consider quite irresponsible now, and in some cases, the interest rates offered were actually lower than the inflation rate in that particular country. So they literally would have been foolish to have turned them down. They literally, in some cases, if the interest rates had stayed, and we'll see in a minute, they didn't, they would literally be paying back less than they borrowed. The attraction was there. So there was just all sorts of very quickly organized projects, hydroelectric plants and nuclear power plants, that, as we all know in our own country, how the cost of those plants have skyrocketed. I mean, the estimates for plants that have taken several years to build, the original estimates are sometimes 1/20th of what the original cost has been. There have been huge construction projects. Yeah.
What kind of supervision was there on the parts of the banks after the money was loaned to these countries to make sure that they were, like if we were loaned money,
right,
we would be supervised, we would have to show a plan to
right.
which this loan was going to pay back the way it
yeah.
should.
That's where the IMF comes in. But frankly, initially there was not near as much, because of the amount of money they had and wanted to unload, they did not take as much detailed responsibility for that as they usually do. Now, I'm not trying to blame it all on the banks either. I mean, obviously the third world governments have got to take a lot of responsibility for this.
We don't have to go out of this country. That's what broke the backs of our farmers. Right at that period of time, 73, 74, The banks couldn't give away enough money, loan enough money to our young farmers.
Well, that's one of the things we're going to talk about that related to the third world debt crisis is our farm crisis. There's absolutely direct relationship. That has to do with a lot of import-export stuff, too. You were going to ask.
Oh, I was going to say, how much of the money ended up in the secret Swiss bank accounts of different dictators?
Let me talk about exactly where that money went. A lot of the money went to just simply, some of it did go to try to strengthen what we would call the infrastructure of countries, the buses, the bus system, the electrical systems, those kinds of things. But too much of it went into large construction projects that primarily, very often, were contracted by foreign companies. So where does the money end up? I mean, the investment comes in, but it goes right back out to a first world construction company that's the one who's in there doing the project. A lot of it did go into military stuff, and a lot of the money was lost to corruption, what you were talking about, and what we call capital flight. In other words, the main people that this money was helping were the upper echelon in these countries. The poor never saw any of this, and in fact, a lot of the construction projects that might have actually had some validity to it, some of them were never finished, because they ran into problems before they ever were completed. Some were, and some certainly have helped. But capital flight is where you have the rich in a country, to protect their own necks, taking as much of this money out of their own home country and putting it in Swiss bank accounts or in other banks to protect it, so that they don't get caught by policies later that says, you know, you can only take so much money out at a certain time, or if their economy drops, they still have money that's in francs or in dollars somewhere else. One statistic is between 1974 and 1982, it's estimated that $84 billion was lost to capital flight out of the Latin American countries. Now, that's about one-third of their debt. But that's personal money. I mean, that's money that's not going to pay off the debt. That's money that people have deposited in banks. Some of that is not necessarily from the third world debt or from the original loans, but a lot of it is. And there was a lot of corruption, too, where a lot of this money went. I mean, there really are, again, I don't want to accuse all the bankers of doing that. There were a lot of bankers who evidently sort of just turned their eyes a little bit. I mean, they just wanted to unload the money, and they were junior officials, a lot of them, and they got rid of the money, then they figured they weren't going to be around maybe when they had to worry about the payment. That's, again, I'm overstating it, but there are some stories when you read through of how some of these officials were contacted at cocktail parties, and some things were signed at cocktail parties and stuff like that. All right, well, at the same time that all this money's floating around, the third world is experiencing problems because oil prices have gone up for them. You know, the people who have oil are obviously benefiting from this. The ones who have to depend on oil just to keep things going are having to pay a lot more than they did before. So that's, again, you know, they're having to pay out more. They're having to bring in loans to deal with that. Then what happens, several things happen. I mean, so all of a sudden you have all these third world countries that are loaded up with loans. And the hope is, okay, with these loans we're going to start all this development and we're going to be able to increase our exports, and we'll be able to pay off the loans, plus our economy is going to grow from it. Well, as I've already said, most of where the money went did not help development to start with. And then a couple things happened that just really sort of dropped the bottom out. One is that commodity prices, or the cash crops that we were talking about earlier, dropped even further. One example is that sugar prices have dropped incredibly in the last 10 years. Because one major reason has to do with, can you imagine what it might be?
Artificial sweeteners.
Artificial sweeteners. Coca-Cola and all those companies, you know, use either corn sweeteners now, or they use artificial sweeteners. The price of sugar, just for an example, went from $1.04 to the kilo in 1974 to 22 cents a kilo in 1977. Now, if you have an economy that is primarily based on sugar, that means that your exports are cut by more than five times your export earnings per sugar. So again, all of a sudden, their income is dropping. The other thing that happened was is that these loans are not at a fixed interest rate for the most part. I mean, these bankers are not stupid. The interest rates were not fixed for, I think, 85% of them or something. Well, we also know what happened in the late 70s around interest rates. The debts are tied to what's called the LIBOR rate, or a London interbank rate, most of them again, and that's sort of the international rate for interest. There's a chart here for interest rates. Well, I won't even look at it for it now. But I mean, a lot of these were loaned at, say, 10%, and you probably remember by the end of the 70s, interest rates were up to 18%. So if you can imagine, one example would be that if you take the debt of Mexico, a 1% increase in interest rate is equivalent to a $700 million increase in 1 year just in interest payments. So now let me repeat that. If the interest rates just go up 1%, that means that the country of Mexico owes $700 million more to their interest payments for that year. So if you increase that by 5% even, you know, you're talking $3,500 million, which is $3.5 billion that they have increased just in 1 year for interest payments. So here's everyone with all this money, they can't keep up with the interest, so what happens? 1980s, banks start loaning back money again to help them pay the interest back to the banks. All right? This is exactly what the IMF encouraged, the bankers encouraged, and that now they're no longer doing it, but they loaned it. In 1983, 79% of every dollar borrowed was used just to pay the interest on previous loans. So, I mean, you just see this is incredible vicious cycle that's happening. You've got these loans, they can't pay them off, now they're borrowing more money, and 80% of that money that they're borrowing is just going off to pay, just going right back out to pay interest. So there's no development taking place. Commodity prices are still low. Their economy is not any stronger for the most part. In fact, it's declining because so much of their resources are going right back out. Yes?
I'm assuming their population is still increasing like 1 or 2% a year.
So right.
Even if they maintain
that's
the level,
right.
Their
needs are
goes down no matter what.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's absolutely right.
But surely the banks knew by this time when they started loaning
you
money.
Think so. You think so.
Surely they knew what was going to happen.
All right, but why do you think banks would do that? Somebody who might understand banking might really understand this. What is the real issue now in these loans? I mean, people say they're not going to be paid off, but what's the real issue for the international economy?
Anything to avoid default.
Right, it's cash flow. See, for the banks, it is primarily the interest payment. They basically already know that they'll never get the principal back. But for them, it's primarily cash flow of interest. Now that's real hard to explain, and I don't completely understand it either. I'm not sure anybody completely understands this, but it is primarily a matter of if the interest payments keep going back, then basically they're fairly, unless there's some major rush on the banks, which, you know, we hope doesn't happen. That's what happened in 1929. Were you going to say something? I thought you were.
The whole thing is, if you went to the bank to borrow some money, you'd have to have collateral.
Right.
These loans, there's nothing back
That's
there.
That's exactly right.
Unless you take the country.
That's exactly right. You're absolutely right. That is exactly the case.
That's what would happen to you. You'd have to put up property or
That's
something.
Right. And that relates to his question about didn't they have some kind of responsibility about what they were going to back this stuff up with? Well, they did.
Collateral, and the bankers weren't prudent.
That's right, exactly. And all of us are going to pay for this. Let me just say that. We'll get to that tomorrow. Unfortunately, it's not going to be. I don't think we're going to pay for it near as much as the poor in the third world already have. But so let me just give you one more statistic in terms of what happens with all these loans coming in and payments going back out. That the net result is that we think usually that the first world gives a lot of aid and stuff to the third world. Well, the net result is that in 1984, the net flow of money from third world to first world or first world to third world, and that is including interest payments, interest payments, trade, exports, imports, and all aid. So in other words, it's flowing into the third world and all the money that's flowing out of the third world, the net balance is that the third world is paying the first world $18 billion. In other words, the poor of this world are actually transferring money to the first world. In 1985, that went up $7 billion, and it was $25 billion was the net balance. So that is what is happening with this crisis.
You mean the rich are putting their money in the Swiss banks, and then it's coming out of the hides of the poor people.
Right. And we think that, I'll say that since 1980, especially in the United States, it's no secret that aid to third world countries has dropped drastically. I mean, the Reagan administration has cut a lot of aid. Right now, I think the total amount of aid that goes to third world from formal U.S. government programs is equivalent to about 4% of what our defense budget is. And 60% of that 4% is military aid. So essentially less than 2% of what we spend on our own defense that we send for aid to the third world.
Barry, that all ties in with Jack Nelson Palmer's series that he had. That's why they want to maintain all these illegal governments down south, because right. If the legal governments got in, if the people took over, they would shut them off.
Right. And in fact, Jack and I have talked about this, and I think we're both convinced that unconsciously, probably for most people, I don't think that most government officials are intentionally sort of in a conspiracy around the third world debt crisis, but I think it has reached a point where the third world debt crisis is one of our most powerful foreign policy tools, because it really holds everyone else at bay. And again, we can talk about that tomorrow. Let me talk a little bit about the IMF, and I want to talk about the direct impact that this has on people in these countries, because that's where it really comes, what it really comes down to, now that we sort of tried to set up the general scenario. Let's talk a little bit about why all these loans were encouraged still, even the ones in the 80s, the second round of loans. One reason is that, the IMF is primarily an institution to keep the international economic order sort of going. And obviously the ones that are most concerned about that are the ones that have the most economic power. One of the reasons for loaning out more money is that if we have products that we produce to send to the third world and they don't have money, they can't buy our products. All right? I mean, that's basic good business sense. I mean, they've got to have money to buy our product. So part of it is that we need to loan them more money so that, again, our own economies are kept going. The second one is exactly what you said, which is to prevent default, which is that the key is that money needs to keep going back in terms of the interest. As long as that happens, and is not a major crisis in terms of people pulling all our money, then everything's okay.
What about barter? What about barter? Couldn't that solve a lot of our money problems?
Barter? I mean, I know what barter is.
Exchange weight for something you've got over there instead of all this.
Well,
giving somebody money to buy our
stuff. So the problem with that is that the way the system is worked out is you always buy products in one or two basic currencies in the world. Usually that's dollars. And so everything is tied to a particular value of a certain currency. But I'm not sure let's not get into all of that, right? But it's a good question. And finally, just to say that as much as the banks are now really scared, the fact is that the banks have profited off of this stuff. I mean, it has been very profitable, even though we think, my God, they're losing their shirts. For instance, in 1970, the seven largest U.S. banks, 22% of their profits came from third world loans. In 1982, 60% of the profit of our seven largest banks came from third world loans. The Bank of Citicorp in 1982 earned 20% of all of its profits just off the country of Brazil. So,
what percentage of the loans? What percentage of the bank or is their loan portfolio?
As a matter of fact, I do have that. I don't have it written down here. I think that it the amount, the percentage of their of the loan. Let's see.
Of their total portfolio of loans.
Yeah, I'm not. I think that it's 20% of their profits came from 5% of their loans. I think that's right. Now I can look that up and try to find it for you later. But I think that I remember that it's essentially that 5% of their total portfolio is to Brazil, but they earn 20% of their profits off of it.
Was that in the last 5 years? That was 5 years ago.
I'm not sure.
What's
I don't.
The trend?
I really don't know. I wouldn't know. I'm don't have statistics on that, and I'm not sure.
What do you suppose the fact that 1 out of 5 people in Brazil have AIDS is going to do with that figure? And if they don't find a cure for it in the next 5 years, it's going to kill off the whole country.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, anything like that will have an impact. I haven't really thought about that myself,
frankly.
Can you
repeat that, please? Was that 1 out of 5 people in Brazil have been diagnosed as having AIDS?
That's right. Because they haven't had any screening of their blood supply.
Yeah.
So it's passed on by blood transfusion.
How can they be profitable when none of the principal is being paid back? How can these loans be profitable to these banks?
Bookkeeping.
Yeah.
Innovative bookkeeping.
See, my understanding is that the interest rates are high enough where as long as they keep getting the money back in, the loan back out somewhere else, that there's always a profit coming in. There's always money coming in. And it is bookkeeping. The money's not in those banks. I mean, we have had the, Continental Bank in Illinois, was that the name of it, that folded about 2 years ago. They did have money. That wasn't entirely third world at all. I don't want to pretend that it was, but there was a significant part of it that was when there were some, and I don't know even all the details of that, but when there became sort of a crunch, they didn't have the principal in the bank. But as long as there's a profit there coming, as long as you're making money off of moving money in and out.
Increase the cash flow.
Right, exactly. I'm sorry.
Did the U.S. taxpayers bail them out?
Yeah, exactly.
For $2 billion or something?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Could be a lot more of those, too. I will say that I think the banks, they're starting now to put aside reserves. Citicorp was the first one, and they put, just about 2 months ago, put aside $3 billion in reserve. Essentially what they're saying is, we're going to start preparing for the fact that defaults may happen. But $3 billion is really still a pretty small part of the total loan. And some other banks are probably starting to follow suit. So at least there's, for so long, the bank said this is simply a short-term cash flow problem. And other people were saying, no, it's not. This is a long-term problem. And I think now at least the tide is, even just in the last 6 months, there's a slight shift in attitude in which people, I think, now are more ready to address the problem. And again, I'll talk about this more tomorrow in terms of some of the proposed solutions. But it has been that proposed solutions were more a matter of a few sort of stopgap measures and then to do more to try to increase development, to increase exports. And essentially the idea was, as long as we get over this hump, then this is going to work out. But I think that's changing.
But isn't it something, Barry, that I bet 80% of those people, these banking people and all these people that are doing all this swindling are professionals?
Are professional what?
Christians.
I'm sure they are.
Christians.
Yeah, and I don't want to give the... See, I mean, I want to be clear that I don't think that most of these people who are involved in this are intentionally out to get anybody. I think they're very blind a lot of times to what's happening and what their effect is. But I think you're right. Let me just end this today's session by talking about the IMF involvement and the specifics of impact, because I think that's really crucial. And then we'll have still a few minutes. This is good because we had more discussion all along. But the IMF, or the International Monetary Fund, as I've said, is the organization that has been really the one most directly involved with trying to help countries pay off their debt. And almost all these debts are tied to, in the actual contract, there is a condition that the country has to abide by the programs of the IMF or the recommendations of the IMF. So what happens is that when a country cannot pay or is having a problem with its loans, the IMF comes in, studies the situation, and then gives them a list of usually what's called adjustment programs. And primarily the purpose is to increase exports and decrease imports. I mean, basically it's like one of us with our personal budget. We try to increase our... If we're a salesperson, we're trying to increase the amount that we sell in relation to what it cost us to produce that product. I mean, that's a very simplified way of looking at it. Obviously, they're trying to get more income into the country to pay so they can pay the loans. Now, what they usually do with that, there are a lot of different ways of doing that, of trying to, of the adjustment programs, of trying to increase the exports and decrease in imports, or increase in your total income. One is simply is to cut domestic spending. I mean, that's an obvious first point. You simply cut what you're spending. So, for example, very often government jobs are cut. In the Dominican Republic, 12,000 jobs were cut from the government in 1 year because directly related to IMF programs. And it's estimated that around 40% of adults in third world countries are unemployed or underemployed. Now again, that is not all related to the debt crisis. And I can't tell you what percentage is, but that has increased dramatically in the sense that there are direct relationships between cuts in domestic spending.
Did you say 1,200 in the Dominican Republic?
12,000. 12,000.
12,000.
Yeah, just in the government sector.
Well, they got a high percentage of unemployment. So where are the poor guys going to get a job?
Right. Well, that's exactly, and that's just in the government programs.
It's such a small country.
Right. Another thing that's very often cut with domestic spending is not just jobs, but food subsidies. A lot of third world countries do have food subsidies on very basic food items, and so there, very often the IMF will require that a specific, we're not talking about just general things, they will say the food subsidy on cornmeal in Zaire has to be cut. And in fact, that did happen, I think, in 1984, and cornmeal is absolutely basic staple this is in Zambia, not Zaire. And the price of cornmeal went up 70% overnight. Now that has now been readjusted. The food, the subsidy has been put back on. I understand somebody who was, I talked to, who's a missionary in Senegal, was telling me that. And that has happened in other places. There were actually riots in 1984 in Morocco because of food subsidies being cut due to IMF policies. Food prices also rise because what also happens is that if you want to decrease imports and increase exports, one of the things that you can do in terms of relationship is you put tariffs on things that are imported. So in other words, they cost more when they come into the country. That gives a negative incentive to buy imported goods because prices go up. Well, I mean, again, all of this is basic, makes good sense if you're trying to pay off a loan. The problem is that who's really affected by it? As the import tariffs go up, and that's often on things like food. I mean, a lot of these countries have to import a lot of their basic food because their agricultural land is being used for cotton, tobacco, cashews, and that sort of thing. Just sort of as a general, actually I meant to mention this earlier, but in Tanzania in 5 years between 1976 and 81, the cost of the relative cost of a truck in terms of the buying power of the commodities, it would cost somebody four times, if they were a cotton farmer, they would have to sell four times the amount of cotton to buy the same truck 5 years later. Or three times the amount of coffee, three times the amount of cashews, or 10 times the amount of tobacco. That really should have said that earlier when we were talking about the commodity prices declining. But it's still related in that it probably in this case means that the truck, not only is the price of the truck gone down, and the price of cotton, coffee, cashews, and tobacco, I mean the price of the truck has gone up, and the price of cotton, coffee, cashews, and tobacco has gone down, probably the truck now has an import tariff on it in addition. So for one person trying to buy that, it's increased. The price of beans in Brazil, for instance, went up about 60% in 1983. And there's some other stuff I'll skip over here about baby food and things like that. And the final thing that I mentioned, there are a lot of these kind of things, but the main ones that I wanted to mention were these kinds of ways in which prices on very basic needs go up to the point where people can no longer buy them, and that includes food. And the final part of this is devaluation. Another policy is devaluing the currency of that particular country. Now that's a little hard sometimes to understand, but what it means is that if we go to Mexico, and I don't even know, does anybody know what the value of a peso is now? I don't know.
A little while ago it was 1,000 pesos to a dollar.
All right, that's a nice round figure. Let's use 1,000 pesos to a dollar. What the government would do would be to devalue, $1 equals 1,000 pesos. Okay. If they devalued it, let's say they devalued it so that it took, I'm sure it probably wouldn't be this much at one time, but let's say that they devalued it so it cost 1,500 pesos to buy $1. Now what that does is has the same effect as tariffs in some ways, because it means now that if somebody's going to export something to the United States, let's say for instance, let's say somebody's going to export tobacco, probably wouldn't be tobacco, but anyway, they're going to sell that to the United States, they're now going to get more pesos for the same amount of dollars. So if they sold a quantity of tobacco that was $10, originally, they would get 10,000 pesos for it. Now they're going to get 15,000 pesos. So the incentive is to export. But what does that do to imports? It does just the opposite. Because now, something that you have imported from the United States that's going to cost $10 in the United States, or is sold for $10 is now going to cost somebody what used to cost 10,000 pesos is now going to cost 15,000. So they purposely will devalue the currency, and sometimes again that's an IMF policy to increase exports, decrease imports. And that's sort of the basic philosophy of the IMF, is that you solve the debt problem by increasing development. And you do that really by looking at the economic structures and, unfortunately, too often ignoring what really the effect of that is, so that people really are directly affected. And just to close, I'm going to read two specific examples. One is from the Philippines. A peasant woman on Mindoro Island, the Philippines, held in her fist a bundle of gnarled mud cake roots. "This is what we have to eat," she said. "This is all we have to eat, even on holidays. Look what we have been reduced to." This talks about the person from Oxfam America, and I won't read all of this. It says, "Most families on Mindoro have access to 1 or 2 hectares, which is about 2.5 to 5 acres of rice land. According to Charney, who's with Oxfam America, the rice they plant, if grown with enough fertilizer, ought to yield at least 3 or 4 tons of unmilled rice per hectare. But Mindoro farmers have been able to harvest only about 1.5 tons of rice, so they're dropping from 3 or 4 tons to 1.5 tons for each hectare, I guess it's hectare actually, because they cannot afford fertilizer. After paying land rent and money borrowed from last year for last year's planting, they are left with only enough rice to feed a family of 6 for 4 months. Because fertilizer prices have risen out of the reach of Filipino peasants because of a national fertilizer shortage. Fertilizer imports have been reduced and for a time were stopped altogether because they were absorbing too many of the dollars needed by the Philippines to pay its foreign debt of more than $27 million. So that's what I'm trying to do, is trying to make it very much at a local level what the impact is. Let me read one more and then we'll end with, see if there's any more discussion or questions. This one takes a little bit longer. This is in Sudan. About 4 million people in the vast African country of Sudan are facing famine. Many have lost their crops to drought. Others had to abandon their fields because of war. In September 1985, as food supplies were running out, Oxfam America sent 33 trucks carrying 2 months' supply of sorghum to refugee camps in the western Darfur region. While thousands of Sudanese and refugees from nearby Chad and Ethiopia are dying for lack of food, Sudan has enough food within its own borders to feed most of them. The eastern part of Sudan produced an 800,000-ton grain surplus in 1985. But we still hear about all these people dying of hunger in Sudan. Well, largely because of its huge foreign debt, now close to $9 billion, the government of Sudan does not have the money to buy the surplus harvest from its own farmers, nor can it afford to pay for drivers, trucks, and fuel to deliver the food to the starving. During the 1960s and 1970s, Sudan received large loans from commercial banks and multinational agencies like the World Bank. In line with World Bank advice, World Bank is not the same as the IMF, but they certainly work along the same kind of policies and work together in many ways. Sudan invested much of the loan funds in export agriculture, including more than 300,000 acres of irrigated cotton. All right, so they invested their loans into irrigation for cotton, which is an export product. Because of the high cost of imported pesticides, fertilizers, and fuel used in raising cotton, the crop costs the country as much as, and possibly more than, it earns by selling it. Okay, so they took these loans, they invested in irrigated cotton, and now though, because the pesticides, fertilizers, and fuel prices have gone up much more than the price of cotton has, now they can no longer, they're not making any money off of cotton.
Because to the oil embargoes? Is that one of the triggering mechanisms here, then the oil embargoes, all of the petrochemicals?
Right, because the price of oil is still up, even though it's dropped in the last few years, it's still up in relation to what it was when they first took the loan. You're right.
Some of the triggers would affect the Arab.
Yeah.
The Arab events.
A lot of it.
72 and 79.
I think you're, I mean, I think that's, yeah, I think probably the one most important factor in starting the whole debt crisis and then making it worse is the rise of prices in oil. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. Thus, instead of helping to pay Sudan's debt, loan-funded development projects have continued to drain the country's resources. Meanwhile, almost nothing has been spent to help small farmers in drought-prone parts of the country to grow more food for local consumption.
A lot of the imports of these countries import our arms from the industrial-military complex of the United States.
That's true. Yeah. Now, a lot of that's given to them, I will say that.
It's not given.
But, on paper, let's put it that way. But they're paying drastically reduced rates. But still, in terms of the proportion of their economy that goes into even managing those, I mean, once you got them, you still got to pay to deal with them. That's true. Yeah, Nancy.
I wonder how that goes into a country. How is it determined onto which goods the taxes will be levied?
I don't know exactly. I mean, that's going to depend to some degree on the team that goes in, and I can't tell you exactly how the IMF does that. I think certainly for the most part it's done on the basis of its economic effectiveness. I mean, what goods are going to make the most economic change in terms of increasing the amount of income?
So the IMF says that the IMF who actually does that, or does the country itself just do that on the advice of the IMF?
They do it on the direction of the IMF. In other words, the loan is dependent. The loan is conditional on the fact that they have to follow IMF. And see, the other part of this is that you're right that there's no collateral on this, but there is some power involved. In fact, because if they don't follow the IMF programs, it means that they're probably not going to get credit anymore anywhere. It means that a lot of what little aid they do have is going to be cut, because that's the way the leverage is made.
A question that I was thinking of is, what if I were in that little country of Swoboda or something and I have this tremendous debt? What would be the consequences if myself and my countrymen simply said, forget it, we can't pay this? And obviously that's one of them, but I couldn't get any more credit for anything, but maybe I'd be better off anyway.
Well, and maybe.
Is there a point where there's going to be a balance of that power and people really are going to say in some of these countries, impossible?
I think unless they did it, several of them did it together, they probably won't, because we're talking about countries that are absolutely dependent on imports and for their basic foods even. For instance, in a country like Peru that's more developed than others, it is the first country that said, we will continue to pay, but we will only pay a percentage of our export earnings. Now the problem in Peru is that a lot of their credit has been cut off, and they are really struggling now. They've done really well the first year, and their manufacturing just went straight up. Their economy is really booming, but now they're at a point where they need more capital investment to keep it moving, and they can't find the money, and they're really negotiating all over the place trying to find that. And I'm not sure exactly. The last time I read anything on that was about 4 months ago, when there was sort of this new president, see if he was going to be able to pull that off. Yeah, you were, yeah.
Oh, Barry, I just was going to go into what you just ended with.
Okay.
And that is that the nature of governments in these countries is not the nature that we have here.
Exactly.
And if they get under too much strain, then the people revolt, and the guy in charge,
that's right,
is hence out. And this is, of course, what happened to Allende in Chile, and Marcos in the Philippines.
The pressures, the economic and international political pressures, are just tremendous on places. I think you might.
Part of admitting that you have to live in a global economy, you can't be an isolationist,
even if you want to. Not with the economies that they have.
But isn't it in essence that the rules really favor their old colonial system?
Right.
The rules favor just one side. It's not an equal two teams playing on a level playing field.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of the proposals, I mean, I'll just, is that we disband the IMF and create an international institution that would still monitor, not to dismiss the loans. See, I mean, that's too simple, because what would happen in a private banking system if you dismissed the loans? The banks would never loan to third world countries again, because they'd say, well, we're not going to take that risk. So, you know, that's one of the proposals that we can talk about tomorrow, is that you create an IMF that is essentially more democratic, and essentially try to start over, and well, not start over.
Isn't there something thoroughly irrational even about the IMF, in the sense that they're trying to encourage exports, and the IMF is really a creature of the developed countries.
In other words, it hurts our balance of trade.
But we don't want to import what these countries have to export except for raw materials as we need them. So there's something not workable even in that whole system. I mean, who are you going to export to? But countries that can afford to buy your product, and those countries don't want to, because they have other problems with the industrialized, like Japan in the case of the United States. So it just seems kind of a thoroughly irrational system.
Yeah, except our balance of trade is not just primarily with third world countries. I mean, we're talking about Japan and Western Europe, which the products going there are going to be a larger, I mean, price-wise, people are going to be larger, as well as you also have to consider the interest payments itself, too. So when it all sort of balances out, it's not totally irrational to still be concerned about these countries. So, oh, geez. I'm sorry, I didn't know. Well, thanks, and I hope you'll come back and we can talk more tomorrow.